So today's Dharma talk, in the newsletter, I called it Being the Only Buddhist in the Room, usually. But for the sake of the recording, it should probably be called Being the Only Buddhist in Your Family. Because once I sat down to write it, I figured it was enough to just focus on being the only Buddhist in your family. But much of what I say today is going to apply as well to other social groups or work or whatever. And so if and when it comes to comments, your questions, you're welcome to bring up those situations as well. So this question was submitted for the Dharma Q&A a couple weeks ago, and I just remind you that the little link to submit questions or topics to me still is in the newsletter. So please feel free to submit a question or a topic that you would like me to cover in a class or in a talk. I find that, if my mind goes along certain, grooves. So sometimes I feel like when I'm trying to come up with something to just talk about, like I'm just going to talk about the same stuff over and over unless you tell me otherwise. So this question was, I wonder what advice you have for people who are the only Zen practitioners in their family. Have you noticed practice taking a toll on marriages between Zen Buddhists and very supportive non-Buddhists, or family matters taking a toll on practice? So a couple things here. I'm just going to talk about being a Buddhist. I mean, here presumably we're all Zen Buddhists, but I think this is whatever I say is also generalizable to being a Buddhist more generally. And also an acknowledgement that obviously there are many people in the country, in our where or wherever you are, who have been raised in a Buddhist family. Our Zen centers tend to be heavily skewed toward convert Buddhists. So we weren't raised in a Buddhist family, and we decided at some point to become Buddhist. But it does occur to me that even if you were raised in a Buddhist family, chances are good that if you are here today or you are listening to this, that you might be the only practitioner in your family. The only, so even if you were raised as a Buddhist, chances are, because when people are raised as Buddhists, it's just like those of us who are raised in Judeo-Christian backgrounds, right? It depends. The family may or may not be very devout at all, or they may just, go to the holy days, or kind of make it, becomes more of a rote or cultural thing or something. And to really engage the practice, really consciously. And those of us at the Zen Center who, if you attend on Tuesdays and Sundays and come to retreats and study and do term student and read Zen books, you're a little fanatical compared to a lot of people. So just, if you're the only person like that in your family, then this applies to you. So I'm going to talk about family first generally, and then we'll open it up for a few, comments and questions. And then I want to say something also about specifically intimate relationships. So, that as a special case within the family. So I was thinking there were three things that determine how much tension, conflict, or whatever might happen within a family, if one person like you is a Zen or Buddhist practitioner. So the three things that it depends on are, one, what is the religious or spiritual practice, if any, of our family members, and how devout are they? So that, if you ever do the term student program and hear people tell their life stories, that's, features very centrally in people's experience. Two, how involved are we with Zen? And three, how do we negotiate the impact of our practice on our families? So we can't do much about one, you know, what our family members' spiritual or religious state is. And hopefully, too, you know, in terms of how involved we are with Zen, hopefully that's also something that, you know, if we're going to be authentic, if we're going to follow our own path, that there might be some negotiation there, but hopefully not too much. I'll get into that. So three, really, the negotiating, the impact on the family or the relationship to the family is where we make the difference. So first, I'll just reflect on number one, the religious or spiritual practice, if any, of our family members and how devout they are. And I'm just talking about this in a way just to let you know you're not alone. Ironically, most negative reactions seem to happen when family members are either devout members of a different faith or they're staunch atheists. Or they've rejected religion for some reason. You know, kind of in between, people are like, you know, like there's not as much of a reaction. But if people have a really strong identity with a particular religion or with not being religious. And obviously the negative response is for very different reasons. You know, the first being, you know, why did you reject our commonly held religious or spiritual tradition? Why is it not good enough for you? Why are you perhaps rejecting us? And in some cases, not unheard of, in some cases, the faith of the family member holds that you are now going to hell. So this can be a big deal. And if the family members, because, you know, different individuals in your family might be very different with respect to all of this. If they have no overt or formal religious or spiritual leanings, it can be very difficult for them to relate to your motivation at all. Like, you just become kind of like, okay, whatever. You're kind of alien and weird. So there's an ironic way that, like, devout family members, even if they disagree with, you know, the path you've chosen, at least understand the desire to choose a path and devote yourself, be involved in a spiritual community and all that. So in some ways it's harder when they're just like, you know, you are just wacky. So the second piece of, you know, how involved are we with Zen? The family reaction is going to depend in a large part, you know, how much time do we spend with Sangha events, volunteering, retreats, and how visible our practice is at home. When we, you know, now we're going to sit meditation, or now we have a little meditation space, or we have an altar, or we have a wagesa, and, you know, they see us wear it, or something like that. So most people with family, particularly if you live with them, have to negotiate this part. And I think it's not uncommon for people to wish they could be more involved, but being conscious of a limit because of the activities, the responsibilities of family, the need to spend time with family, the need to, you know, be in harmony with family. And I've definitely seen people damage their relationships because they spend all of their spare time on Zen. But I've also seen people tragically cut off their Zen practice because family members disapprove or resent it. So for many of us, family is okay with our practice to a point. As long as Zen seems fairly casual, like a hobby, it's no big deal. But later, you know, maybe you receive Jukai, you take the precepts, You have this little, I don't know, vagesa that you wear around your neck, or maybe at a later date you take the step of Zaike Tokuto and you get a Dharma name, and sometimes, so there's people who call you by a different name, or maybe you ordain as a monk, like I did in my case. So my family, they didn't care at all about my Buddhist practice when I took the precepts or I got all involved with my Zen center. But when I wanted to ordain, they were like, what the hell is going on? Like, that just passes a line, right? And people worry about, frankly, a cult, even if they don't really know what they might mean by that, about the influence that a Zen community might have over you and over your life. I mean, what else, what are they gonna ask you to do next? So how do we negotiate the impact of our practice on our families? So the first thing I thought about was explanation. And I find that explaining is, of generally speaking, of very limited usefulness. But if you have an opening, if you have a family member or, you know, someone else in your life who is actually going like, so what about that Buddhism thing? It can be very helpful to explain that Buddhism does not exclude or conflict with other faiths. Like, nobody cares if you're also Christian or also Jewish or also atheist or also anything else. It's like it deals with a completely different set of questions. Matter of fact, we say, you know, the famous Buddhist teaching is like speculation about, you know, the origins of the universe or, you know, the existence of a deity or whatever. It's just like, we just say, don't waste your time. You can't know. So just we got a lot of work to do. Let's get to practice. Just, you know, if you want to wonder about that, however you feel about that is fine. So that can put people's minds at ease. And it can also be helpful, depending on who you're talking to present Buddhism as a practical method for living a happier life, and emphasize our lack of deities. Because most people assume that Buddhism is theistic in some way, because that's what religion is. Like, most people cannot get their heads around a non-theistic religion. Like, they're like, but, you know, so the Buddha, like, you worship the Buddha? No. Like, I participated in interfaith group once, and, like, ironically, I think the L. Ron Hubbard? Scientology. So there was a Scientologist on the committee, and ironically, I had the most in common with her, because when we were designing these multi-faith services, you know, whether you were Muslim or Jewish or Christian, different brands of Christianity, you know, let's talk about God. Let's make a prayer and let's address God. And so she and I would always be like, So people just, you know, they really think that this still involves a God. So it can be helpful, particularly if somebody's atheistic or a-religious or something, to explain that we don't. But, like, you know, that you don't have to delve very far into Buddhism, and you see a lot of religious looking stuff. So, you know, just be aware that it's a shallow explanation. But I think you will find that most people don't want to know very much. Most people, like, so when I first, especially once I thought about ordaining, I tried to explain to my family and explain why it was important and explain why it was a valuable practice. And I felt like they didn't understand or they didn't want to. And bless her heart, it was a little hard to hear, but my sister finally said, "We don't care about Buddhism. All we care about is how it's going to affect our relationship with you." for most of our family members and friends, and that's all they care about. It's a rare person who really wants to know anything about Buddhism, which is why we say, like, let people ask, and perhaps even more than once, like, let them ask and then just give them a little bit. And if they're still interested and they want to know more, well, okay. But, you know, our intention, our tendency probably is to go like, bleh, you know, oh, you want to know about my, you know. So, yeah, just be aware that for the most part, people are just, you know, what does this mean to our relationship? Another aspect of, you know, how we can negotiate the impact of our practice on our families is to try to normalize our sangha whenever you can. So it's really helpful to invite family to something fun, like our sangha sharing or open mic night, which I hope we have that kind of thing again, or if you're local, to a picnic, you know, so the family members, if they're willing, they can come and realize, okay, you know, I'm just sitting around and they're talking about the weather and movies and, you know, they have dogs and they're, you know, like they're normal people. This can really help. You know, and that's why it's tricky with the cloud zendo. How do we have more of those things that you know, are more open and social? But hopefully we can find some way to do that so that family members can you know, check that out on occasion and realize that. See, one of the big, huge icebreakers for my family, as I got ordained and then, I don't know, it was like 7 or 8 years later that I got married, my second marriage. And then we had the wedding at the Zen Center, and we had the reception at a nearby house that a Sangha member put on. And the Sangha members, like, obviously the vast majority of people at our wedding were Sangha members because my husband was a member of the Sangha as well. And they organized a potluck. And my parents, once people identified, oh, you're Domio's mom, you know, you're Domio's dad. And then the family members were like, oh, we're so grateful for her to be part of the Sangha. And my parents were like, and the food was good and people had fun. And, you know, we had a keg and a band and, you know, so I think that really helped put their mind at ease that I wasn't attaching myself to a community that was going to be bad for me. And, you know, just go ahead and mention non-Zen stuff about, you know, me or your Sangha members, or, you know, go do fun stuff with Sangha members or something, some kind of communication that, yeah, we're normal people. And then for some people, not for all, but for some people, when you get into practice or you want to get deeply into practice, the temptation may be to forgo some of the pleasures and distractions of lay life, the way monks do, to say, become vegetarian, forgo or strictly limit alcohol consumption, to minimize or stop watching TV and movies, to radically simplify your life and get rid of everything, to spend your spare time reading Zen texts instead of doing crossword puzzles, to use your vacation time to attend a silent Zen retreat instead of doing whatever leisure activities your family usually does together. And all of these can be valuable practice. I mean, there's a reason why they are part of traditional monastic practice. But they can cause significant alarm to your family members and/or create a sense of separation and judgment. So it's very typical for my fellow Soto Zen priests. You know, a lot of times we'll just be going about our lives dressed in normal clothes, like not doing our priest thing. But if someone, knows you're a priest, like, then you know, when you walk into a party and there's beer, they'll be like, oh, you know, like there's just this kind of Puritan reaction that we, that people assume, you know, certainly for a priest, but I think also it can be extended to other, if you're a serious practitioner of Buddhism, that you're going to judge alcohol consumption or food or dancing or I don't know what else. So I think, you know, it's good to remember the middle way in all things. So on the extremes first are one, doing whatever you feel called to do without any concern about how it will affect your family. That's one extreme. And the other side is doing only what your family approves of and understands, only what is not going to impact them in any way, only what maybe they're not even going to notice. You know, that's the other extreme. So hopefully we find a middle way where we're being authentic and we are being true to our own call to practice while, you know, taking into consideration how it impacts other people. And I find it's helpful to look and see, ask yourself, what can you do? What compromise you can make that will give you the biggest bang for your buck? So here's my example, which is when I was a monk, so, and I had, you know, my head's completely shaved, I'm living in the Zen center full time. So when I went home to visit my family, you know, a little bit of a culture shock, and I would try, you know, initially kind of try to keep some of those forms when I was at home. But I remember finally just like, okay, I'll have a beer. And kind of watching my parents watch me drink that beer. It's like, like they were, like it was a visible relief, you know, that that I was still on the same planet as they were, that I was okay with this, that I could relax enough to do that. So in a sense, like you might look for that kind of thing. Like what's something that you can just go ahead and do or not do or whatever that will really, you know, matter to your family. And then, you know, you have a little bit room, more room to play with, you know, like, and if you can, if you're lucky enough to have this kind of relationship, to negotiate honestly, you know, I really want to attend this all day retreat. I'm going to be gone from dawn till after dusk. So how about the following weekend, you know, we do this, or, you know, some kind of compromise like that. And another way that we can negotiate this skillfully is to not make too many changes at once, but just, you know, push the envelope a little bit at a time, daring to do things that might make our family members uncomfortable at first. You know, maybe we want to put our hands in gusho and say the meal prayer before meals, and, you know, just acknowledge it's going to be weird at first for your family. But, you know, so do that, but don't do that and, you know, introduce a chanting service several times a day, you know, whatever else, just a little bit at a time. But on the other hand, to not compromise ourselves too much, because it doesn't make for a healthy relationship if we are suppressing or hiding something that we really like to do. Another aspect is that practice should make us a better spouse or partner or parent or child or sibling, etc. So we want to make sure to extend our practice into our relationships so that they see and feel the benefit, to really see those relationships as being part of the venue for our practice, one of the most challenging parts, in fact. And you know not only are you negotiating this relationship with family right, but you know your practice is on the right track if your family encourages you to do it. You know, I've heard that before, of just like, why don't you go to the Zen Center this weekend? You know, because they know that you like it helps you. It you know, it actually is beneficial to you, and you're you're a nicer person to live with if you practice. And then another aspect is giving up our need for them to understand or approve. So this can be very tough. But if we do this while still maintaining the love and respect in our relationships, it can really benefit the relationships. It can relieve a lot of tension when, like, you kind of wanting the other person to understand or approve, and they're just often that's really not possible, except at that really, you know, basic level of just like, well, it seems to be good for you, so, you know, more power to you. But it's rare for partners to have, you know, to be totally on the same wavelength about practice and the importance of it. So my story that I like to tell about this is that, you know, when around the time that I was really struggling and I felt alienated from my family and that they didn't understand, and I wanted them to understand, and I don't know, it was just that all that tension that I, during our annual Sagaki ceremony, which is the Festival of the Hungry Ghosts, and we're kind of inviting unresolved stuff to be with us during that ceremony. I had a sense, and I'm not saying that this really happened, but I just had a powerful sense that my grandfather was present and was witnessing, and he had died a few years before. And I was really close to him, not in the verbal, like, let's talk about our lives kind of way, but just in an intimate way. And he had been a devout Catholic. And I got a sense that he was watching our crazy ceremony, chanting and processing and all this. And I got a sense that he was watching, and that he understood, that he related, that he understood. And I just had this great sense of, like, healing, that what I did was kind of it met a need that I didn't even realize I had. I didn't realize I longed for that, you know, for my family to understand. And when I got that sense from my grandfather, I was like, cool, I'm good, you know, and I was able to relax. So I didn't have to be as defensive about my practice or, you know, conscious of how my family members thought about it. So I wanted to, let's see, I have quite a few things to say about intimate relationships as well. So how about we just take like 5 minutes or so to just do some additional sharing and questions and stuff, and then I'll get back to the topic at hand. Bob.
Let me be a little, maybe too much revelatory for some, but I come from a family that has been so broken in terms of religion. So my great-grandparents were Lutheran. My grandmother is Lutheran. My grandfather is strong Catholic. He's not even buried in the same cemetery as the rest of the family. Then my dad, with that basic, he grew up in a Catholic household, sort of, kind of, but then he got kicked out of the Catholic high school because he asked too many questions. Married my mom, who was a Baptist, right? So we searched around every place we went to different churches. I mean, I probably went to 6 different churches in the first 8 years of my life. Okay, so then that's the basis. My sister has gone off to be with the Mennonites, okay? And I went off to the Unitarians. And now I've converted, quote, quote, no, added on the notion of the Zen Buddhists. And I've never been happier. And my sister is like, what? Oh, and my wife is just like, go to the Zen Center, get out of the house, and she'll be fine. So I related to everything you were just talking about in one lifetime.
Thank you. Adine and then James in the Zendo.
Yeah, I think, yeah, for myself, it's, I think, as I'm sure a lot of you have heard, there is such a thing as being culturally Jewish, right? Not necessarily. So for me, I mean, on my rupa here, I mean, I've got a Star of David, you know, because that's something, I don't know, that's, I think for a lot of Jews, it's a cultural heritage. It doesn't necessarily mean that you believe in Hashem or anything, you know. So yeah, and as far as family goes, another part of my identity being gay is if you sort of get a foretaste of it, because if your family rejects you for being gay, then you could really care less what they think about anything. It doesn't matter then. So, yeah.
I it's thought just, about just, that before, yeah.
Yeah, you know, it's like, okay, that's just how it is. So, yeah, that's just my thing.
Thank you. James.
Yeah, I relate a little bit to what Bob was saying, because in my people in term student have probably heard before, my dad was an Assemblies of God pastor when I was a kid. So I grew up in the evangelical church, and then he left that and I became more agnostic. And my dad, meanwhile, rejected Christianity entirely, has gone from being an Assemblies of God pastor to being completely rejects it all and thinks it's all a bunch of just legend, and is somewhat of a studying Taoist, really. He doesn't practice so much, but and my mom's always been able to. But my wife grew up in a Presbyterian household, because my mother-in-law is the organist of the Presbyterian church over in Hillsborough, the old Scotch church. She's been the organist there for like 30 years or something like that. So I've been very fortunate in that that denomination is very open-minded. My mother-in-law is very open-minded. My wife's very open-minded. And when I started practicing Buddhism, she kind of came along for the ride and was going to when I was in the Thai forest tradition, she was coming to that temple with me regularly. We brought the kid before Anjali was born. We even brought Anjali when she was a baby. What you said really struck me, because I think the thing that's been most successful is that precisely, or that's helped me the most, is precisely what you said about seeing the impact on me and the way that I interact with the family and the way that I interact with others, and knowing that while my practice might take me away from the family, it also benefits the family and benefits everybody. And she's very much supportive of that. If anything, she's more supportive than I think she's going to be, right? So I find myself like holding back, you know, on like, well, I kind of want to go do this thing, and I kind of feel like I need to go, and I need to, and she's like, go for it, you're fine. I'm like, are you sure, really? Because okay, thank you, you know, like, and it's the dichotomy there is very interesting for me to observe. But as time's gone on, I'm feeling more relaxed about that, and like, oh, okay, she's going to be okay with it, and it's going to be fine, and you know, it has such a positive impact, I think, on the family that she's more than willing to. So she probably also would just as glad that I'm out of the house too, but I think she's probably glad that I'm doing something beneficial. She's used to me being a professional musician early in my life. So she's like, if you're going to be away from the family and away from the house, I'd much rather you do this than, you know, be in a nightclub until 2 a.m. and
yeah,
all that type of thing. So
thank you.
Thank you.
Ruth Ann, did you have something?
Oh, yes. I'd love it if you could comment a bit. Historians have said that when a country loses a war, they embrace the former enemy's religion. And before the Vietnam War, you could find a Buddhist temple maybe in half dozen American cities. And This came up for me when I was, I think, the second time around with study on facing whiteness, the program actually I did through Brightway a couple of years before COVID or something like that. And I understand that my friend who grew up Buddhist doesn't practice. I understand for her that how come Westerners took our religion, even though she doesn't practice, and she knows I do, and she knows I lived in Southeast Asia for 15 years, and I have Asian friends who are not Buddhist, but still, I mean, I get where that question comes from, but still, you know, it's out there, I think, in our diverse American culture, and I mean, I get that. I can't change that, but I think it's, in a way, under this umbrella. Thank you.
Yeah, I don't think I have a whole lot to say with respect to that, because I'm not really, you know, I guess I'd have to be an expert in sociology or, you know, history of religions or whatever, but I do know that it's encouraging that there is more discussion within not just Zen Buddhism, but I think probably other forms of Buddhism. What do you want to say? More cultural sensitivity, more acknowledgement that we have appropriated Buddhism and Zen and different forms of Buddhism. And I think, you know, in some ways, it's when we think about it, it's like, well, I'm not going to give it up. Even if it was a little ballsy to take it, I'm not going to give it up. But I think we can avoid the violence of appropriation by our attitude, even if we're changing that attitude after the fact. You know, that when we recognize, all right, you know, what we have here is a weird American Western adaptation of our impression of what Zen is, and that we have a lot that we could learn, that we shouldn't make assumptions that we have it right or that it's superior to cultural Buddhism, that, and we have picked and chosen what aspects we want to use, and we should have some humility about that. So I appreciate you bringing that up. But I do want to move on to intimate relationships. So I feel like in our intimate partnerships, all of what I already talked about still also applies, right? Especially in the early stages. So it depends on the partner's spiritual life, religious life, how involved we are in Zen, and how we negotiate that. Let's say we've already, you know, given as useful an explanation as we can. We've tried to normalize our Sangha community. We try to partake joyfully and thoughtfully in certain pleasures of lay life, so reassure them that we're not judging them or headed into a life of joyless, uptight asceticism. That we've applied practice changes gradually, let people get used to it. That we've been careful to extend practice to our relationship, so we're a better partner. And that we've tried to let go of the need for approval or understanding. So let's say all of that is, we've worked on all of that, but still issues may arise. And honestly, deep practice can be very challenging for intimate relationships. So there's no research on this, and after all, people split up all the time for other reasons. But it is not uncommon for people to split up a year or two or three after one or both of the people get really involved in Zen. Or both. I think sometimes it's even more likely if both get involved. And really involved, I mean, you know, lots of time spent, a visible practice, but also the intensity of your own aspiration to uncover the truth, to wake up to reality, to liberate yourself from your karma. Because fundamentally, it comes down to change. Practice changes you. And generally speaking, this changes for the better, but it's still change. And a relationship established with certain parameters and expectations may not be able to grow. It may not be able to change or adapt to meet these new conditions. Or you or the other person may decide it's not worth trying to make it adapt to the new conditions. And I mean, practice isn't the only thing that brings about these kinds of changes either, but practice can. And some of those changes are changing desires, changing, you know, our interests, our priorities, the way we want to spend our time. Maybe previously our preoccupation was planning our next vacation or designing our house remodel, but now you're thinking about a week-long silent retreat in order to see if you can awaken to emptiness. It's like, it's a bit of a shift. There's changing habit patterns. Partners get used to one another, adapt to one another, rely on each other being predictable, fairly predictable, for better or worse, right? So when we enter into a relationship, we may have addictions, you know, whether physical or kind of subtle. We may have anger issues. There may be dysfunctional dynamics within the relationship that we don't know how to get out of. Maybe we spend time in distractions, or we're willing to break precepts. And it sounds great, right, that you might be fixing these things, but actually that can be very unnerving for a partner. And one great example of this is if you are emotional, you tend to, you know, at least in the past, you tended to be more emotionally volatile, and then you gain more equanimity. It can seem like emotional withdrawal. It can seem like if you're used to a certain level of emotionality and reactivity with someone, and now they're just like, yeah, well, whatever. I mean, it can feel like you're withdrawing. So it can be read that way. Also, over practice, generally, we become less dependent. When we turn that light of practice onto our lives, we've ended up in relationships that serve our emotional and psychological needs for acceptance and reassurance, safety, protection, you know, staving off loneliness. And for many of us, love, partnership was our first experience of feeling like we're really okay, that we're lovable, that we're connected. You know, that's the great attraction, right? And so we continue, many of us, to turn toward intimate relationships to serve that need. But over time in practice, we learn to meet those needs through our relationship to the universe itself. We don't need our intimate partner in the same way anymore. And this is a very tricky change to navigate. It can alarm our partner, especially if perhaps they still need us that way. And we may realize that the relationship is no longer worth what it requires to maintain. We used it for a particular reason, and now that reason is gone. So now what? Also during practice, if we want to go very, very deeply into practice, there are almost always periods of doubt and despair and not knowing. As we let go of the self that we have maintained, it can be disorienting at times. And before we discover something new, I don't know, like it's difficult for me to have imagined the emotional territory that I tread during my junior years of practice as a monk. I cannot imagine bringing another person with me through that. I think it would have been very difficult to always, you know, maintain the connection and rapport and explanation and all of that when I, you know, I just wanted to like kind of go within and dwell upon my own existential angst. So in a way that's kind of self-indulgent, right? And we have a changing sense of self in deep transformative Zen practice. We allow ourselves to be changed down to the core. It's possible to see the whole world in a new way, and who knows where our particular relationships are going to fit into that. So this is why it can be easier to get into an intimate relationship after the transformative years of practice. Because Zen it's perfectly compatible with intimate relationships. But the period of growth and change can be rough on existing ones. But it is it's a matter of commitment. You can transform within an existing relationship if both people are deeply committed to it, no matter what. So I left my first marriage to practice, and I'm not proud of it. In some senses, it was selfish, and I was impatient. If we had stayed together, it would have required much more compromise. But in the end, I think the results could have been the same. So if you are wanting to stay true to an existing relationship, I think just awareness of all of this helps immensely. Just a consciousness of this, like, you know, growth, and that the need to not get too out of sync with your partner. Patience with your partner if they get unnerved or alarmed or worried, recognizing this is something natural and that's something that can be worked with. Share your experience with them to some extent, although, like I said, unless they practice as well and are at the same point in their practice, it's unlikely they're really going to understand or relate. And some of it may even be confusing if you share it. So I think that's a certain sense of sadness too. Sometimes if we recognize we're going to go on a journey that our significant other can't necessarily go with us on, but that can be okay. And that's part of that, like, individuation and like not so much dependence, of recognizing there can be deep respect and intimacy, even if there's part of us that's going to develop in a way that we can't explain. Try to reassure them that you love and accept them, pay extra attention to them, spend enough time with them, and view the commitment to the relationship as a non-negotiable. Like your relationship to your kids or parents or other aspects of your life, which aren't going to change fundamentally, regardless of what happens in your practice. I mean, you could kind of make a mess of those relationships, but they're still going to be. Whereas, like, our intimate relationships, usually we have this sense of choice, like we've chosen this person and we can choose, unchoose the person. Obviously, at some point it may become untenable, but if we just assume it's non-negotiable until that point, it helps keep us focused. And just trust that awakening, liberation, enlightenment, etc., is perfectly compatible with a loving, intimate relationship, just one that is based on choice and not on need on your part, anyway. So, I only have 1 minute. So, I don't know. I'm happy to stick on for another 10 minutes. If you need to blink out if you need to get going, that is fine. I will say the closing verse, but then I will continue with questions. So abiding in this ephemeral world like a lotus in muddy water, the mind is pure and goes beyond. Thus we bow to Buddha. All Buddhas throughout space and time, all honored ones, bodhisattvas, mahasattvas, wisdom beyond wisdom, maha prajna paramita.